This is Fred Rivara and Dimitri Christakis for JAMA Pediatrics. You can listen to this and other podcasts on our website at www.jamapeds.com. Well, today for this September issue, we have two very interesting articles to talk about. One has to do with depression after premature birth. The other has to do with febrile UTIs. Dimitri, tell us about depression after premature births.
So this is a study looking at depression and anxiety in parents of very premature infants. There have been several other cross-sectional studies that have looked at this phenomenon, and as you might imagine, it's a pretty stressful and depressing time to have a child that's born that prematurely. What this study adds is a few things. One, it includes fathers, which is relatively novel. It's large. It's much larger than any other studies that have been done before. And it's longitudinal, so it follows these kids sequentially over 6 months from birth. And it also has a control group of term infants. So they enrolled families of very premature infants, less than 30 weeks of age, and they have a control group concomitantly enrolled with babies born at 37 weeks and later. They had 113 preterm moms and 101 preterm dads and an equivalent number of full terms. And as I said, they followed them at 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, and 12 weeks after birth and looked at depression and anxiety. And, you know, sort of to cut to the chase, it's kind of what you would expect. What's interesting as much as anything is two things. One, just how high the prevalence of depression and anxiety is compared to...
Yeah, I was really struck by that.
Yeah, so, I mean, just to let our readers know, I mean, the percent of patients who are above the clinical cutoff for depression at birth is over 40% for mothers and fathers. And 12 weeks later, it's over 20%. And the numbers for anxiety are quite similar, almost identical, frankly, 40% down to about 20%, mothers and fathers both at discharge. And I think this is significant for a lot of reasons. One, I was alarmed by it. I don't spend a lot of time in the NICU, but we certainly see the kids after NICU. Right. And what that basically means is that if you're seeing a kid for follow-up from NICU stay, there's a 20% chance that their mom and father are both clinically depressed
and anxious.
And frankly, it's the pediatricians who are in the position to do something about it because these people probably are not seeing – I mean, the mothers might be seeing their obstetrician. The dad's probably seeing no one. But no one's thinking about depression or anxiety in these families.
And what is the effect of parental depression and anxiety on the kids?
Yeah, so that's a really good question because we know that parents, mothers and fathers with mental illness have significant effects on children's cognitive and social development, particularly early in life. And when you sort of add that to the fact that premature infants are already at risk for developmental and cognitive, what we call sort of soft cognitive morbidities, even apart from any serious consequence of a NICU stay, their environment is really important. So having a clinically depressed mom, dad, or anxious mom and dad, in addition to that, gives them two hits, which, again, is concerning and definitely provides an opportunity for a primary care pediatrician to get involved. I just want to comment on two other things that I thought were interesting. One was that they did not find that this risk was predicted in regression analysis by socioeconomic status, education, any of the things we usually think of, which again is important because it shows that the effect of this is strong enough that it kind of supersedes any of the normal things that we think of as being
pervasive threat.
Yeah. It's rare that we see those things not predicting a bad outcome. So here, it's clearly a pretty strong effect, the challenge of having a preterm infant. And the second thing I'll say is that apparently depression and anxiety decrease more quickly in fathers who access NICU support services during the hospital stay. What was interesting to me here was that if you have a situation where 40% of parents have a problem, you don't actually wait for them to come to you. It should be universally rolled out.
Yeah, what bothers me is thinking about then these needs of all of these parents and where these children are hospitalized and where they get follow-up in terms of what are the availability of those kinds of resources to care for these parents. I mean, we're spoiled by being in a children's hospital or a university that has made great efforts to provide those kind of services. But if you're in a community hospital where, frankly, some of these kids are being cared for, or you're a private practitioner in a community, you may not have those resources at hand. And so it means really sending parents out into the community to seek those resources themselves. And we know that insurance sometimes doesn't cover some of the mental health needs of families. And frankly, even getting an appointment can be difficult for families. So that's what really, really worries me about what this means for our patients.
Yeah, I mean, my hope is, I mean, you know, most pediatricians are not comfortable prescribing psychotropics to parents directly, but most internists now are. So the hope would be that these are not sufficiently depressed that they require mental health services, but they should be referred to family practice doctor and internist who would feel comfortable pharmacologically managing their depression and anxiety.
Right, it's the kind of collaborative care model that is actually piloted out here in Seattle, where a psychiatrist acts as a consultant to the primary care practice, and the primary care practice really manages the mental illness, such as depression and anxiety, in conjunction with help from the psychiatrist. Okay, second paper is a very important study clinically, which is looking at the issue of whether delay in the treatment of children with febrile urinary tract infections increases the chances of renal scarring. Previous studies have been done on this, and the studies have been conflicting. Some studies have seemed to suggest that a delay in treatment would increase the risk of scarring, but other studies have not found that. So this was, I think, a really great opportunity where these individuals, the investigators, use data from two longitudinal studies. One was the RIVER trial, which is the randomized intervention for children with VU reflux, and the second was the CUTI study, Careful Urinary Tract Infection Evaluation Study. These are both studies conducted here in the United States for children 2 to 72 months of age who had a proven UTI. The children had to have reflux to be in the RIVER trial, and those children who did not have reflux but otherwise qualified were in the CUTI study. And these children were enrolled, and they had baseline assessments of renal scarring using DSMA scans, and then they had follow-up assessments, again with DSMA scans, at some point in the future. And what these investigators did was look at the time between when the parents first reported the children to be febrile and when they started antibiotics, as shown in the medical record. And they looked at 480 children here, so it was really quite a large study. And what they found was that the crux of it here is that 7% of children had new renal scarring on the outcome DMSA scan. And they found that for every hour that antibiotics are delayed, the odds of new renal scarring is increased by 0.8%. So that if you delay
every hour, you're
saying?
Every
hour. So if you delay antibiotics by 48 hours, you have a 47% increased odds of having renal scarring, which is really quite significant.
That is significant.
So, you know, what does this mean, I think, for the practicing pediatrician and for families? Well, I think, first of all, it means that in children that might have a UTI who present to your office febrile, you probably ought to go ahead and get a urine to make sure they don't have a UTI. There are various decision rules out there that say, well, you wait for 48 hours or 72 hours before you check a urine. That increases the likelihood of getting UTI. But here, this study is showing that delaying more than 48 hours really significantly increases the chance that a child is going to end up with renal scarring, so that you probably ought to evaluate the child sooner rather than waiting for the child to come back.
So, but then the issue that always comes up, Fred, is how would you collect the urine?
Well, that is a really important issue. While a clean catch urinalysis might be useful in terms of telling you whether or not the child has a UTI, you still need to get a urine for culture results. And I think that in children 2 to 72 months of age, a lot of those are going to have to be by cath in the younger children, which is a problem.
That's a problem, I think. I mean, that's the problem with, you know, it's always a sort of trade-off in clinical medicine because, you know, what's the number needed to cath in order to find a UTI
right.
48 hours earlier?
Right. And, you know, frankly, in a lot of clinics that may not do a lot of caths, the nurses may not be very good at it.
Right.
And a little girl. Ancient history, when I was a house officer,
we
used to do super pubics
yeah.
all the time. Now we don't do that anymore, or hardly ever. So it really is collecting a urine by a catheterization. On the other hand, if it means that the trying to save the child from renal scarring in a young girl, young female, who is febrile, it probably is necessary.
So let me just get this straight. You're saying that you would cath every girl 2 to 72 months of age who comes in with an unexplained fever because it's a UTI until proven otherwise. You're worried about the risk of renal scarring, so you're going to start cathing people?
Well, the data that these folks quote in some of their discussion here is that white female children younger than 22 years of age who have a fever more than 24 hours have a probability of UTI that is higher than the testing threshold for most clinicians. So, yes. younger than 2 years. Not 72 months, but younger than 2 years. In kids older than two, you probably try to get a clean
test. With no history of UTIs.
Yeah. I think the other message here is for parents, in that if you do have a child, particularly a child with a urinary tract history, urinary tract infection history,
well, that changes
is it. That you should be coming in, you know, the first day the child has a fever rather than waiting until the child might be febrile for a couple of days coming in. And then I think the third thing is, again, for parents is, or for physicians, first of all, go ahead and prescribe antibiotics when you send the culture off. Don't wait the next day until the culture comes back.
Yeah, provided you got a reliable sample, right?
Provided you have a reliable sample. And secondly, for the parents, is to make sure you go ahead and fill the prescription on the way home rather than waiting a day or two to fill a prescription. Thank you very much for listening. Again, please go to our website at www.jamapedes.com to listen to this and other podcasts.